Coming up Sunday morning at 9 on Hometown Heroes, a 93-year-old Navy veteran from Taft who has written a captivating book about his World War II experiences.
They asked for volunteers who take some Marines in D-1, and I volunteered because I thought it sounded like a great adventure.
Hear how that adventure turned out for him and the major role it played in that battle. A brand new episode of Hometown Heroes, Sunday morning at 9, right here on 1560 AM and 97.7 FM KNZR.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where each time we take a trip back in time, listen to stories from our greatest generation. We want our veterans to know that we appreciate what they've done for us, that we greatly appreciate their service and sacrifice. We want to make sure that price of freedom that's been paid for our sake will not be forgotten. And along the way, as we listen to these stories, we sure do learn a lot. Another way to learn, of course, is to read, and I learned a ton. And, you know, I thought I'd heard a lot of the stories over all these hundreds of veterans I've interviewed, but reading the book, The Gator Navy, The Amphibious Navy That I Knew in World War II by Victor Killingsworth, sure added a lot of perspective to my understanding. And hopefully you'll get some of that today on this program. We can't hear every story in the book because there are just too many good ones in here. So if you want to read them all, I'll tell you how to get his book, The Gator Navy, a little later on in the program. But 93-year-old Victor Killingsworth of Taft, California is our guest today. And you've been in Taft for most of your life, a life that you were fortunate to have after World War II. But originally from Horned Toad Land out in Kalinga. And tell me, when you were born on November 11th, 1920, how was it that you got the name Victor? I know you weren't part of the conversation, but you heard the story later, I'm sure.
Well, I was born on Armistice Day 1 year after World War I. So my mother felt that that was appropriate and named me Victor as a result of World War I.
That's one of the best stories I've ever heard about why someone got a name, other than, hey, it sounded good. That one actually has some story behind it. So growing up, you moved from Kalinga to Taft when you were 3 years old, and there have been a lot of stories told about that oil town in Central California. In fact, there was a movie made about high school football in Taft. Were you an athlete going to high school there?
I played tennis and basketball a little bit, but I wasn't considered a red-hot athlete.
And then junior college there, were you on the track team or something like that?
No, I was on the golf team again, and I took part in the Golden Glove boxing.
That's what I read about in here, the Golden Glove boxing. How'd you get started with boxing?
Well, I had a friend that was quite an athlete, did a lot of working out, and he was a boxer, and he said, Vic, why don't you, you're pretty good at that, why don't you try it? So I worked out with him and entered the Golden Gloves at Taft College and got knocked out in the final round, so I got a silver glove, but I didn't get the Golden Glove.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a lot better color than most of us have when it comes to our boxing careers. Eventually, you went on to the University of California. And, you know, every veteran that I interview, there's one question that I ask of every single veteran, because everyone seems to remember something. And from reading your book, I know you have a very vivid memory about December 7th, 1941, because it changed a lot of things for you. Tell us where you were and how you found out about what happened out in Hawaii.
Well, I was going to the University of California and staying in a dormitory called Oxford Hall. I was studying for finals on Sunday morning, December the 7th. Finals were to start Monday morning, so I got up early and was studying, turned on the radio, and heard the announcement that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor. I couldn't believe it. I thought it was some kind of a joke at first, and then I ran down the hall to my friends who lived in another room in the dorm and ran in and told them we were at war. Well, they were studying for finals. In fact, the whole dorm was quiet, and they didn't see any humor in my running in and pulling a joke on them like that. So I've turned on the radio, but they threw me out in the hall. I ran back in and turned the radio on again, and they threw me out. After about three trips being thrown out, the radio warmed up. In those days, radios had to warm up. You didn't just turn them on. And the announcement came over the radio that we were at war. And, of course, then they ran up and down the hall, and pretty soon it was bedlam in the dorm.
Wow, I can only imagine what that must have felt like and looked like. Did you have to take that final the next day?
No, I called the university the next morning to see whether we were to take finals. And they said, oh, yes, you've got to take finals. You know, Berkeley is not known for being easy. So we did take finals. I don't think it changed many grades because there was so much commotion. But we did have to take them.
And I know this might be a tough one to go back all the way back in your memory and figure what your state of mind would have been. But I'm sure you remember something before that day, because clearly that day changed the world, it changed this country, and it would change your life. But before that happened, here you are in school at the University of California. Did you have an idea of what you were going to do after that and what your life was going to look like, what your career goals might be?
Well, while I was going to Cal, I met a gentleman by the name of Gardner Blackman, who was head of personnel for Associated Oil Company and had their main office in San Francisco. And he had offered me a job in personnel administration and said, when you get through, come and see me. We've got a job for you. Well, I changed all that, as it did for every young man trying to decide what to do. Completely changed our lives, all of us.
You worked in the shipyards there in the Bay Area real briefly. In fact, we had another veteran on recently who was working for Kaiser there, building all those Liberty ships. But you decided there were some other ships that might be in your future. What led to your decision to become a Navy man?
Well, one thing, my vision, I didn't think I'd be a pilot. I had no sense of depth. But I liked the idea of being able to see different parts of the world, and I thought Navy would do that. I did work at the Navy Yard when I got finished at Cal. And I finished in the summer, about August of 42, I guess it was, and worked for Kaiser Shipyard in building Liberty ships. I figured I could contribute some way by doing that. And then I enlisted. Well, I enlisted in the Navy in February while I was still at Cal. I did enlist then. And they allowed me to finish college. And when I finished, I told them I was ready. And they said, we're not ready. Go find a job. So that's when I worked for Kaiser. And they didn't call me until the end of November. And we were scheduled to leave on December the 3rd from San Francisco.
Can you remember what expectations you might have had, what you thought the Navy was going to be like? I'm sure what it ended up being was a lot different, but what do you think your expectations were?
Well, coming from Taft, a desert town, and the biggest boat I'd ever been in was a rowboat, I don't think I had much expectation. It was just a thing to do. I looked forward to going in the Navy, so it was a pleasure. They took 30 of us from the Bay Area. They took 15 from Cal and 15 from Stanford. And they took 15 from UCLA and 15 from USC in the South. And we traveled by train. The 30 was from Berkeley, from San Francisco, went by one train. The 30 from the Southern California went by another train. But we arrived in Lincoln, Nebraska at the same time. And we all got on the same train. So that the 60 boys from California ended at New York Club University at the same time.
That's a long way from Taft, from the oil fields to the Ivy League, in a hurry there. What were some of those early training exercises or eye-opening things that you experienced?
Well, first of all, we got there in the winter. We arrived late because the train was snowed in Lincoln, Nebraska. So they had a big celebration because we were the anniversary class 1 year after Pearl Harbor. We were supposed to start December 7th. And all the Navy bigwigs from Washington were there. We missed it all because we got there a day late. So they put us all on and together. There was 1,200 midshipmen. The other 900 were mixed up as they came in. They mixed them, but we ended up together on the 12th floor of the dorm there. And so some of the discipline we weren't used to. The weather we weren't used to, especially from California. One of my friends there was from Massachusetts, and he used to tell me, be sure to keep your face covered, your lungs will freeze.
And you fell for that one, huh?
I fell for that one, especially when they would have a fire drill at the middle of the night. We'd have to run down 12 flights of stairs and stand at attention in the cold in our shorts until we were dismissed and run back up 12. They wouldn't let us use the elevator, so we had to run back up 12 flights of stairs.
Sounds like you were ready to move on to a warmer climate, huh?
Yeah, the standing watch was pretty tough in those days, especially if it was outside. Inside wasn't so bad, but outside was pretty rough.
Well, and we've got a lot to talk about overseas because you have very vivid stories in this book from some of the major battles in the Pacific, but there was a very significant event that happened before you ever went overseas, and I don't know if you knew how significant it was going to be at the time, but tell me how your life was changed by one of your next stops stateside before you went overseas.
We were sent from New York, from Columbia University. We were given orders, which we were not to look at till we got away from the university. And my orders sent me to Virginia Beach, Virginia, to amphibious training. And probably the most dramatic event was when I was training troops in the landing boats, and we trained on the beach at Chesapeake Bay. And they had big signs, Kaiser signs, at each end of the landing beach. On one side, it said, no personnel beyond this point. On the other side, it said, no naval personnel beyond this point. So I was running landing boats into the beach, and one of my boats veered off and started an erratic trip to the beach. So I followed, finding what's going on. As I got closer, I noticed three girls on a blanket just on the civilian side of the sign. My sailors were trying to chase these crabs, which they have back there, sort of walk sideways, and were trying to get these crabs to go up towards these girls' blanket, and they were screaming and jumping up and down. So I, as their commanding officer, had to get off and tell them to get back on their side of the beach, naturally.
Yeah, you had to get off and get them under control. You couldn't sneak a peek at the sunbathing girls or anything.
So one of the girls asked me what I did in my spare time, and I told her I stayed on the base. She said, don't you ever date? I said, well, there's about a million guys for every girl in it, so there's no point in it. She said, well, Virginia has a couple of sisters up in it. You could get a date. Well, Virginia was Peggy's sister. And she said, my husband's jealous. I'm not going to do anything. So the other girl said, well, I'll take care of that. You give me your phone number. So she did. She called me and told me that she had a date with Margaret. So I called Margaret, and she said she wouldn't go with me unless she brought her girlfriend. I had to bring another guy. So we double dated, and that was the beginning of 68 years of romance.
So let me get this straight. You agreed to the date. You'd never met her, seen her, had no idea what you just knew her sister was pretty good looking.
That's right. That's correct. You can go by that.
So then you go to pick her up, and she didn't say, hey, wait a second, this isn't the guy I want to go out with.
No, we got along very, very nicely. We went to the Monticello Hotel and danced in the starlight room of the Monticello Hotel. We had a great time. It was a fun time. So for the next 2 or 3 months, I was there about 3 months, we dated.
When you moved on, did you think you were ever going to see her again?
No, I probably didn't think I would see her again, because I figured I probably would not come back to that port again, you know. And I had no idea how long the war would last, so.
So what'd you tell her before you left?
I can't remember. You'll have to ask her.
And I can't remember either.
You can't remember either right now? All right. But you guys wrote letters for a while, huh?
She wrote to me every week, and I was overseas for 28 months. So I have a lot of letters, and we really got to know each other. But I did come back one time for advanced amphibious training. They sent me to Port Pierce, Florida. And when that was over, they had a new amphibious ship coming off of the ways in Portsmouth, Virginia. So they sent us back there, and we dated a couple of times before our ship was ordered out to sea.
And you talk about all this amphibious training, and we've had a lot of guys on the program that had a variety of roles in a lot of those different landing craft. Was this kind of a big adventure for you, getting to understand and learn how to use these different machines and ships?
Yes, it was. I really enjoyed it. It was a lot to learn. Like I say, coming from the deserts of California to the ocean was a big change. But it was fun. When you're young, you adapt quickly. And I met some great guys, and it was a great experience, an adventure.
You remember what it was like to head overseas? Because obviously you joined the Navy, you knew this was coming at some point. When that time actually came, what do you think your outlook was?
Well, I think we were, you know, you're trained up to this, and training is so important. So we were anxious to get started. We were anxious to make a landing, and we were anxious to use the skills that we had been taught. So our ship left Portsmouth, Virginia, and went through the Panama Canal, landed in San Diego. Camp Pendleton is right near San Diego. So we picked up the 4th Marine Division with a flotilla of amphibious ships and took them to San Clemente, and they practiced the landing there. We brought them back to San Diego and took them back a second time to San Clemente after worked out a lot of the flaws. And the third time we picked them up, we were gone from the Marines having liberty and partying on Saturday night. The next thing you know, they were landing on the enemy beach.
Yeah, isn't that a striking contrast? But you had a bit of a scare before you got to ship out even. And I imagine there are a lot of sailors, maybe some even listening today, who have woken up from a bad dream in which somehow his ship left without them. For you, that wasn't a dream. We're going to get to that story when we come back. We'll also hear the story of why you volunteered for dangerous middle-of-the-night duty, taking men in before the start of an island invasion. Victor Killingsworth of Taft, California, our guest today. Hard to believe he's 93 years old when you listen to him, isn't it? If you want to see what he looked like back then and what he looks like now, check out the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. You'll also find instructions there on how to get your hands on his terrific book, The Gator Navy, The Amphibious Navy I Knew During World War II. And we'll try to make some more of those pages come alive when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Lafleur.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you, men and women who have put their lives on the line for the freedom that you and I enjoy every day. If you grew up in Taft, California, maybe you bought a baseball bat or a tennis racket from our guest today, Victor Killingsworth. For decades, the owner of Taft Sporting Goods. I'm often asked how I find the veterans who appear on Hometown Heroes, and I have to flip that question upside down a bit, because for the most part, I don't find them. They find me, listeners like you, rat them out, so to speak. I want to thank Miguel Sandoval, a loyal listener, for today's program, because he obviously views his father-in-law, Vic Killingsworth, as one of his heroes. He sent me Mr. Killingsworth's book, The Gator Navy, and boy, did I devour it. A great read. So I want to say thanks, Miguel, and by the time we're done, I think all our listeners will be glad that you told me about your father-in-law. All right, well, we left off with you referencing heading overseas and the invasions would be for real. But before we get there, I'm curious to know on those practice landings, because now you can look back and you think about being at Kwajalein and Saipan and Tinian and all these places where you landed troops. Looking back, do you think those practice landings domestically with no real opposition, where in theory it's a safe exercise, do you think that those prepared you for what you eventually encountered?
very, very definitely they prepared us. We had our advanced amphibious training at Fort Pierce, Florida, after we left Virginia Beach, Virginia. And I never experienced anything like the waves that we ran into in Florida. When we had our final run in Florida, we lost 20% of our personnel in that one landing operation. Our boat group commander broke his collarbone, and we had a broken jaw, we had broken teeth, we had broken arms, broken legs. The waves were 10 foot high. I can remember taking some Marines out in my boat, and one getting so sick, he was laying on the bottom of the boat, and I happened to look at him. I wasn't particularly, maybe I was smiling, I don't know, but he looked at me, and he said, if I ever get out of this landing boat, you'll never get me in another one. It was rough at night. We lost 20% of our crew. I fortunately was able to help out quite a bit that night, and I didn't get hurt. And so they replaced all of our officers and crew members within days. We were, because they were ready to ship us overseas, they had to replace them quickly.
And again, this is just training here in the States before you ever went overseas. And just to be clear, when you say you lost 20% of the crew, you mean they were injured, not that they were killed.
They were just injured, like they were broken legs, broken arms. We had a really bad night that particular night.
Well, I could see how that would get your attention. And getting back to the West Coast, you said that the next time you guys were going for real and the next time the Marines would hit the beach was an enemy beach. But you actually almost missed your ship. There's a pretty good story there. You had to play a little catch-up, right? Tell me how that happened. This was the Sumter?
Yeah, the Sumter. Well, we came into San Diego, and while we were on the East Coast, I stood a lot of extra watches so the guys could go home, and so they owed me. So we came to the West Coast. I said, you guys are going to have to pick up the slack because I'm going to have to go on Liberty. So they did, and I went on Liberty. When I came back, my ship was gone. I walked down the docks and looked around, and no, how can you lose a ship? But we did. And so as I was standing there wondering what the heck happened to my ship, a shore patrol guy came up, and he said, sir, are you looking for your ship? And I said, yeah, what happened to it? And he said, well, they had to move. They went to San Pedro for repairs. So the captain had left his Jeep there, and I wasn't the only one that missed it. It was four of us. The other three officers took the Jeep and went to San Pedro and left me. So
how'd they leave you? Did they know you were missing too?
I don't know how they left me, but anyway, I hitchhiked, took taxis, and took me all night. I pulled into San Pedro at the docks there about 6 o'clock in the morning, thinking I was going to catch the very devil from the captain or worse. And when I came aboard ship, the officer of the deck said, the captain wants to see it. I thought, oh boy, I'm in for it now. So when I went to his stateroom, he apologized for leaving me, and he had coffee and sweet rolls. And so we had a great time. My fellow officer told me that I was the luckiest guy in the Navy. Everything I did was, came out of it smelling like a rose. So
I've read your book. I kind of have to agree with them, the way it all worked out for you. Somebody was looking out for you, that's for sure. And we're looking at some maps here right in front of us as we record this show today at the studios of KNZR, the affiliate in Bakersfield and Kern County that airs Hometown Heroes. We appreciate their hospitality. And out laid on the table here are invasion maps. One of them says top secret, confidential, only in combat area. And this was the first invasion that you were part of, right? This is Kwajalein we're looking at.
Yes, this was the invasion of Kwajalein Atoll. I had a rather unique part in this one. They asked for volunteers to take some Marines in D-1, and I volunteered because I thought it sounded like a great adventure.
What's wrong with you? D-1, this is before everyone's going to hit the island. So basically you're going in with a skeleton crew, knowing there's tons of Japanese and tons of guns on this island, and you're basically tiptoeing your way onto this island and hoping nobody catches you. What possessed you to volunteer for that kind of duty?
I really don't know now looking back on it, but at the time I thought it was a good idea. So I volunteered, and the USS Sumter, which is a ship I was on, it was an APA 52.
So that's a ship from which all of these landing craft launch.
Well, we have a flotilla of ships. But anyway, as we got near Kauai, well, first of all, I should say, the first night after we left San Diego, or maybe it wasn't the first night, the first few nights, we pulled in behind the big island of Hawaii. And this was our first experience with war. Tokyo Rose came on the radio that night and told us we were hiding out on the, behind the, and suggested that we turn around and go back because the Japanese had many body bags waiting for us, that we would not go home, we would not see our wives or our loved ones. And so that was kind of a shocker that she knew where we were at and where we were going. But as a fun thing, on the way there, I was standing watch. And after watch one night, I went in to get a cup of coffee. And the stewards are black, at those days were black stewards. And they had access to the officers' wardroom because they did our cooking and also served their meals. And so they also could eat whatever they wanted that was around there. So they were in the wardroom having a snack, and I went in and had a cup of coffee, and I was sitting where I could hear them. And they're all guessing where we were going. They guessed all over the Pacific. And there was one older gentleman. He was about, I say older, he was probably in his 30s. They were probably in their teens, late teens. And finally I heard him say, "Boys, I don't care where I was going. I just like to look back and see where I've been." And I've always thought about that. A great way to think, philosophy of life. Yeah. But anyway, we, for this volunteer thing, that when we got close to Kauai, our team was pulled away from the amphibious forces, got in within a mile or so of the island, and blacked out. We had no lights on at that time as we cruised in. And they put me over the side in my landing boat, and then they put the Marine scouts, it was about, I think, a couple dozen or so Marine scouts, in rubber boats. And it was a horrible night. There was no moon. It was pitch dark. Rain was pouring down, as I recall, and the swells were 8-10 foot high. It was an awful night.
Were you starting to think maybe you shouldn't have volunteered?
Yeah, I was wondering whether we were going to make it, really. I didn't know how those little rubber boats looked like ducks. Yeah. So anyway, they tied them behind my landing boat. And
is this a LCVP or what?
Yeah, LCVP. And I took a compass bearing on the island, and I towed them in close to the island and then cut them loose. And they paddled in the rubber boats. My orders were to report the next. I had the radio and was in touch with the fleet. And so it all depended on what I did. We had two landing plans, one to go inside the lagoon, one to go outside. If we had to go outside, we would have had hundreds more casualties. So we wanted to go inside if we could.
So you're scouting out this lagoon to see if you can land there the next day?
Yeah. Well, there's an island called Jacob, which is a short distance from the main islands, and there was a passageway where the bigger ships could go right off Jacob Island. So we took the scouts in and cut them loose, and they paddled in, and then they told me that I was to go in the next morning and find out whether they had taken the island so they'd know which plan A or plan B.
So if they were successful, you guys would have a passageway on this attack that would greatly increase your chances of survival and reducing those casualties.
The only problem is they did not give me orders as to what to do after I cut the Marines loose. So here I am out in the ocean, pitch dark, pouring down rain, heavy swells, wondering what the heck am I going to do for the next 3 or 4 hours.
How many guys did you have on the boat with you?
I had just four men. I had two gunners, a coxswain, and a mechanic. So I told the boys, I said, we got to do something. We can't stay out here in this weather. We'll be swamped. Rain was really coming down hard. So I decided to go inside the lagoon, and where it was out of the weather, and we can make it. So we did go inside the Kwajalein Atoll and run up and down. I was concerned about whether we're going to run out of fuel, but we had our tanks full when we started. So we ran up and down inside this Japanese atoll till it was daylight. And then we worked our way back and picked our way through the coral reefs and landed on the beach on the lee side of the Jacob Island, hoping that the Marine colonel who was in charge of the Marines would come out of the brush.
Yeah, that's what struck me, and you tell that story very beautifully in your book, The Gator Navy. I was just imagining myself in your shoes, and that uncertainty that, I mean, we watch television, we want the cliffhanger, right? Or we watch the end of a basketball game, we want to see if that buzzer beater is going to go in, and to me that seems like the kind of moment where the sun comes up and you're there and you're waiting, is it going to be the Marines or the Japanese, right?
As we pulled into the beach, I had both the gunners had two 30 caliber machine guns trained on the brush, and the other mechanic and the coxswain had carbines. I had my 45 pistol. I don't know what we thought we would do if a group of Japanese came out, but about the time this was happening, we all ran into another problem. There was a sand spit that sort of controlled the entry to this harbor, and there was a Japanese gun emplacement on it. And they were apparently had their heads down with all the rain and so on. They weren't sticking their heads up out of that gun emplacement. About the time I saw that, I'm thinking, uh-oh. We're in trouble. You got, you know what's coming from the front. You don't know what's going to happen from the back. But a Marine Corsair fighter plane came over low over the water, and he spotted them, and he took them out with his guns on his plane. So about that time, the Marine colonel came out of the brush waving the Japanese sword over his head. He said, Swabby, called me a Swabby. He said, call the fleet, tell them we got them. I said, how many did you get? He said, we killed about 30, so with knives and bayonets while they were asleep. So we took that little island of Jacob, and immediately they started bringing in Marine artillery, and the 10th Marine artillery set up on that island, and then they began pounding at Japanese from on the backside of Roy and Namur.
And there were no casualties, right, from your group?
No, the Marines didn't suffer one casualty. And they did it quietly. They didn't want to make any racket or noise because the Japanese could have reinforced the island real quickly from one of the bigger islands. So they had no indication until we started pounding with the artillery from the backside.
And we can look back now and see how successful that operation at Kwajalein was. But what I got from your book was, without that part of it, and you called it Operation Flintlock, I think, right? Operation Flintlock, without that and what you and those other guys who volunteered for that duty did, the whole battle could have been a lot different, right?
It would have been different. The Marines suffered around 300-400 casualties, and the Japanese suffered 8,000 casualties. So by going in on the backside, it saved a lot of American lives. Yeah.
Well, and the one thing you described there too, I want our listeners to understand, your life was saved there too, it sounds like. If that Corsair hadn't swooped down at that right spot, maybe you guys wouldn't have survived?
That's right. It was Nipponthuck. So everything worked out, thankfully. Yeah.
So I guess you're probably a fan of Marine Corps pilots, huh?
I'm a fan of Marines. I have nothing but respect for Marines, especially the fighting Marines.
And I imagine the folks listening today, Marines or otherwise, are starting to develop some respect for you and what you did, not to mention the great job you've done preserving it all in your book, The Gator Navy. More information on that at hometownheroesradio.com, and as well as the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. If you're on Facebook, just type in Hometown Heroes Radio, and you'll see photos of many, many of our guests over the years. More of Victor Killingsworth's World War II story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. They say a picture is worth 1,000 words, but when it comes to making my mouth water, I don't need 1,000 words, just 2 of them. Mongolian beef.
Okay, two more. Ming's Restaurant. And I guess if you want to know where to find it, I should give you two more. Las Banas. That's where I grew up. And I'm guessing Las Banas is somewhere you pass through every now and then. And if you drop in for the Mongolian beef, you might start calling it what I have for years. My favorite place to eat. Period. He may not look old enough for this to be true, but the owner, Paul Cito, has been working his magic in the kitchen there for 45 years now. It's all delicious. If you're a garlic fan, try the Baja shrimp and thank me later. But the Mongolian beef is absolutely unmatched. The flavor, incredible. The texture, tremendous. I can't do it justice with words. You just gotta go taste it. One word of caution, do not go on Monday because Ming's is closed on Mondays. So pick another day, tell them I sent you, and let me know if your taste buds enjoy it as much as mine do. That's Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in lovely Las Banas, California.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 93-year-old Navy veteran Victor Killingsworth of Taft, California. Thanks to his very thorough, extremely informative, and really well-written book, The Gator Navy, I had a decent idea ahead of time of some of the questions that I might want to ask him. So when we sat down to record this at the studios of KNZR 1560 and 97.7 in Bakersfield, California, a station that actually airs episodes of Hometown Heroes 7 days a week, if you can believe that, we started talking and we just kept going and going and going. After a while, it became pretty clear I wasn't going to be able to do his story justice by trying to squeeze it all into just one episode. So we're going to hear his voice on next week's show as well. Before the break, he explained his role in the invasion and even pre-invasion of the Kwajalein Atoll, all of 16 square miles worth of land in the Marshall Islands. Fewer than 1,000 people live there now. That's how small an area we're talking about. It was a very successful operation in February of 1944, as evidenced by those drastically different casualty numbers you heard Mr. Killingsworth cite for the Americans as compared to the Japanese. And you had a pretty eye-opening experience that reminded you there were other people depending on the outcome there besides just the Allies and your enemies.
It's not all serious. Some things are less serious. But after my part of the landing was over, I went over on the other side of the atoll to an island called Allen. And the Japanese had a radio station and a pier there. And I pulled in there, and my buddy Sid Cohen was there, and we were sitting on the dock. And two things happened there that I think were worth mentioning. One, a landing boat came in. When the fight started, the Polynesian people left, and they started moving down this chain of Fishgut Islands. And so they didn't have any food. They had left their homes. So we sent boats down to pick them up and tell them that we weren't going to kill them. They were okay, and we were going to feed them. So while we were there, one of these boats came in with a family of Polynesian, a couple of families of Polynesian people. And it was interesting to see these dirty Marines with beards dig into their K rations and dig out the candy and hand it to the Polynesian kids. They were in the boat. But the Polynesian culture is such that the father eats first. Then the mother eats, and what's left over goes to the kids. Just the opposite of our culture, particularly. Yeah. So when the Polynesian men saw the kids with the candy, they would go over and take it away from them. And you'd see one of these big Marines jump down in the boat and grab him. Of course, they were little people. Grab him by the neck and take the candy away from him and hand back to the kid and point, tell him, no, 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 don't do that. So that was fun to see that difference in our culture. And then the second thing that happened there, a couple of three boats came in full of Marines, and the major got up on the dock, and he said, men, remember what I told you this morning? Take prisoners? He said, abort that. Now I'm telling you, no prisoners. We will take no prisoners. The first one of you guys that brings me a prisoner, I'm going to shoot him. So it was two different things on that dock that were important. But the reason the Marine had said that was because just prior to that, a few hours or hour before, one of the regiments in his division had tried to take a Japanese pillbox, and the Japanese had gotten up on top of the pillbox with a big white flag and was waving it, as saying they wanted to surrender. So he moved the men and the Marines up close to the pillbox in order to take prisoners. And when they got up it real close, they set off a charge and blew the thing up and killed a lot of the Marines in this man's regiment. So he was not about to take prisoners. That was the reason for it.
Yeah, and that was not uncommon, from what I understand, in that part of the world at that time. You know, you mentioned the story about giving the candy to the Polynesian kids, and I saw that emotion welling up in your eyes a little bit as you remembered that. Was that something for you that you knew you were fighting for your country, for the freedom of Americans, but when you saw that, you realized, you know, there are a lot of other people and their freedom that we're fighting for, too?
That's true. And you realize there, I think, first time I thought, well, you know, there's a lot of other cultures in this world other than ours. Being a boy from a small town in the desert of California, it was an awakening for me.
Well, and there would be more awakenings to come, because you had some other pretty intense battles, too. And you didn't learn your lesson about volunteering, did you? You kept doing it.
No, I had fun. It was, you know, when you're young, it was a crazy way to have fun. But when you're young, you do foolish thing. And so after that operation was over, we went back to Pearl Harbor to be outfitted and resupplied and get ready for the next operation. And we had a newspaper on the ship. It came out every day. And in the newspaper, they said they needed a volunteer for the next operation. In the meantime, I had been boxing since I'd boxed at Taft College. The chaplain of our ship was a boxer, and he and I'd go down in the hold the ship and box and enjoy ourselves. I got to know him very, very well.
Isn't that kind of unwise to box against a chaplain? That sounds like that's pretty dangerous.
Well, he was a nice guy. He didn't seem to mind. So anyway, the captain asked for a volunteer for this job. So I told, and he said, if anybody wants to volunteer, talk to the chaplain. So I told him while we're boxing, I said, I want to volunteer for that job. And he said, Vic, you're crazy. But the captain had gotten real tough on their ship, and we'd had some real bad experiences. And I thought, I need to get off of this ship, do something, get away from this guy.
And the chaplain probably didn't want to lose his boxing buddy, though.
Yeah, right. And he told me, he said, Vic, you're crazy. He said, I'm not going to turn your name in for 72 hours, and I want you to change your mind, think about what you're doing. And 72 hours later, I told him, well, turn my name in. I haven't changed my mind. So.
But you didn't know what you were volunteering for.
I didn't at that time, no. Yeah. It wasn't as bad as it sounded.
Well, tell us about it. This was as you guys were getting close to Saipan, right?
Right. We were getting ready for the Saipan operation. And they wanted to set up a boat pool in Saipan that would take care of unloading supplies. Little did we realize how important Saipan and Tinian were. At that time, we didn't realize that Tinian was going to be the main base that they were going to drop the atomic bomb from. So we didn't realize how the big deal it was.
In fact, the ship that took the atomic bomb there, you almost ran into in one of these operations. And, you know, that's one of the things that I really appreciated about your book. You didn't say that, but besides your first-person accounts, you took a lot of time to research some of the big picture and get statistics and have quotes from generals and things like that. How'd you pull that off? I'm really impressed with how thorough your research and your explanation was.
Well, I went to the library and tried to get books of that period, written by generals and so on. And I picked up some of the information while I was in the islands, too, a lot of it, the different divisions and people working there. So
you know now how important Saipan and Tinian were and the things that have been said about those actions. But at this point, this is just another island, and you've got a job to do, and you needed to find out what that was.
Well, what happened, they wanted to set up this boat pool that would take care of unloading ships and supplies. So when we left Hawaii, we went to Inuit Atoll. And I transferred from the Sumter onto an LST. I don't know the name of it now. I wish I did. But on the LST, the colonel was there, and all of the assault waves, the first six waves that land on a beach are assault waves. So the Marines that were in those waves were on that ship. And then I took myself on there and some of the crews that were to land with me. And so the colonel and I went over the landing plan. Now, it's very important in a landing plan that you land exactly where you're supposed to on a beach. So the Air Force took pictures of the Japanese beaches the day before, and they dropped them in the water for us the night before. So we knew as of one day earlier what the Japanese defenses looked like. So the Marine colonel designed the landing so that we made sure that if it was a blockhouse on the beach, that he had a satchel charge or bazookas or something taken out. And if there's a machine gun nest, that we had bazookas that would take it out. So it's very important that we land the exact spot. So we planned this landing out and the troops that were to take part in each area. And then we rode on the LST from Niuetuk to Saipan.
And once you got there, you talk about these assault waves and all these Marines. And earlier you said how much respect you have for the Marines. Did it ever strike you what must be going through their minds and whether they thought they'd be living a week from then?
Well, I think it's the same thing again, Paul. I think it's training, 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 training. When I looked at those young men, 17, 18, 19 years old, they were like, you're going to a football game and they're going to win. They were so excited. But they had lots of guts, too. Yeah.
I guess you were a pretty old man at, what, 23 or so?
Yeah, I was about 23. So I was the old man of the group.
Yeah, 23 years old, and now you're 93. Going to be 94 come November. And we can all tell how clear those memories remain today. Maybe writing them down in that book has helped keep them that way. I really don't believe in cliffhangers, and very, very rarely on Hometown Heroes do we break a veteran story into two episodes, but as I mentioned, I really think that's what we need to do this time around. Otherwise, you'd miss out on some more really intense and captivating stories from Victor Killingsworth. To read about everything you've heard on this program and even more, contact Mr. Killingsworth for a copy of his book. I have this information online at hometownheroesradio.com as well as the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. But I'll give you the phone number here over the radio as well. You can call Mr. Killingsworth. Hey, you can even tell him thanks for serving our country. Call him at area code 661-765-2360. It's a little unwieldy to try to clearly state the email address here on the radio. I don't want to have to tell you S's and Sam and all that kind of stuff. So just find that address on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Next week, the rest of Mr. Killingsworth's story. How did it all unfold at Saipan? How did the USS Indianapolis, the famed cruiser that delivered the elements of the atomic bomb to Tinian and later paid the ultimate price for it, how did the Indianapolis almost spoil the plan of attack for the boats under Mr. Killingsworth's command? How did Saipan produce his closest calls yet? What are the images that are seared into his brain that still make the emotions well up 70 years later? What unique artifacts did he bring home from the Pacific? And once he got home, how long did he wait to marry that young lady that he'd met before shipping out? And even just recently, what was it like to experience the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Kern County? Those are just some of the questions we're going to answer next week with 93-year-old Victor Killingsworth of Taft, California. Hope you're looking forward to it as much as I am. We're out of time this time on Hometown Heroes, but until next time, I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.